Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The hardworking son of poor Mexican immigrants is tried, convicted, and sentenced to death for the murder of his beautiful billionaire wife. Except he didn't do it. And now he wants vengeance and retribution for the wrongful conviction. That's the premise of the debut novel by my guest this hour, David R. Dow. It's titled Confessions of an Innocent Man. In real life, working with students in his death penalty clinic, Dow has represented over 100 death row inmates during their state and federal appeals. He's the founder and director of the Texas Innocence Network. He's also Cullen Professor at the University of Houston Law Center and the Rorschach Visiting Professor of History at Rice University. David Dow joins us for the hour live from Houston. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Ben. I'm happy to be joining you.
I want to mention that I really enjoyed this book. It was captivating reading, but also driving home a lot of points, which we'll talk about this hour, that everyone should know about our criminal justice system. So congratulations to you on achieving both of those things, making it a captivating read and an important read.
Thank you very much. If I had to say what my two objectives are, I think that I would probably say those were my two objectives.
All right. I want to mention you've also written several nonfiction books on the topic of capital punishment, including the autobiography of an execution. David, later in the program, I'd like to have you share more about your real-life experiences representing death row inmates. But first, let's talk about your new novel. Tell us more about the premise of the book.
Yes, I would be happy to. The premise of the book is that there is a young man. He's born in the United States, but he grows up in Mexico. The only reason that he's born in the United States is that his father wants him to be born in the United States so that he's a U.S. citizen. But immediately after being born here, he goes back. He grows up in Mexico. His family is very poor, but also very loving. His mom and dad are very devoted to one another, and they're both very devoted to him, and they want to make sure that he grows up with a better life than they had. So they save what little small amount of money they can. They eventually send him to college in the United States, or he chooses to go to college in the United States, and then he stays here. His parents both die, actually, while he is in the United States in college, and he goes from college to culinary school, not because he had any great desire to be a cook or own a restaurant or anything like that, but because he entered a competition while he was in college, and the reward for the competition was a scholarship to culinary school. And so he basically did that because it wasn't going to cost him anything, and he found that he liked it. He eventually moves to Houston, opens a small restaurant and bar. It is a place that receives great critical acclaim, both locally and statewide and even nationally. And then in the course of running that restaurant, he meets a wealthy woman. She's a philanthropist. She is a single mother. She was married when she was very young, got divorced. She has a son who is just a little bit younger than the main character, whose name, by the way, is Rafael. And Rafael meets Teresa at his restaurant, and originally she wants to back him financially and have him open other restaurants, but he doesn't really want to do that. And in the course of telling her, no, 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 I don't want to do that, they develop a friendship, and a friendship turns into a romantic relationship, and the romantic relationship turns into marriage, and the two of them get married. And then shortly after they're married, and this is not a spoiler alert because all of this happens pretty early in the book, she's murdered. And he, of course, is suspected. And the reason that he is suspected is because he would have been suspected in real life. Most women who are killed inside their homes are killed not only by somebody they know, but by either a spouse or a domestic partner. So one reason that he is suspected is because he is, in fact, her spouse. Another is that he is Mexican and brown-skinned, and I think we lie to ourselves if we say that doesn't make a difference. It does make a difference. A third reason is that he is a whole lot younger than she is. And then finally, and this is something I won't say too much more about because I would rather that people read the book and learn more about it, but while at the same moment that his wife has been killed, he is in bed with another woman. And so you add together those four things, and the spotlight is going to shine pretty hard on him. And he's suspected, and he's eventually tried, and he's convicted, and he's sent to death row. And so the book is divided into four parts. The first part is their relationship. The second part is his life in prison. The third part is his life out of prison after he is eventually exonerated, which he is. And then the fourth part, which I don't really want to say too much about, is what he does to the people who he believes are responsible for having wrongfully imprisoned him for all of those years. And that's the basic outline of the book.
Okay, David, well done. With no spoilers there. I have read it through to the end. It's worth the read. Let's pick up there with the point that you make, that you, in your novel here, turn victim and perpetrator designations on their heads. You explore what happens when injustices occur to both of those who are guilty as well as those who are innocent. Why did you want to do this, given your work over the years?
I think that I wanted to do this because I've obviously had a lot of experience of dealing with people who are stereotypically clothed in either a white hat or a black hat. So who wears the white hats? The judges, the prosecutors, the police, the prison guards. Who wears the black hats? The bad guys, the people who are in prison for doing something wrong. And in the course of my work, I've discovered that there are people who wear white hats who are not really that pure, and there are people who wear black hats who have some really remarkable qualities and admirable qualities. And so I created characters in the book. I created judges and prison guards and police officers and, most importantly, inmates. And I wanted to construct them in very rich detail, and I wanted to show how there are some prison inmates and some of the characters in the book who are people that you really would not want to spend even 2 minutes with if you had your druthers. But then there are others who, despite the fact that they are on death row, which means that they killed somebody, are people who you might find yourself really drawn to. They're interesting people. They read books, they write music, they play chess, they write poetry, they read poetry, and I tried really to present the entire range of characters. So not all of the guards in the book are the same, not all of the prisoners in the book are the same, not all of the judges in the book are the same, not all the police officers in the book are the same. And I tried to create those characters realistically because I think that when we encounter those sorts of characters in literature, they are too often two-dimensional, and they're just flat. And I know a lot of these people, and I know some of these people really well, and in real life, they're not flat. And so it was very important to me to have all of their voices be authentic and not be caricatures in any way. But at the same time, I do not simply invert the categories. That is, I don't make the good people bad and the bad people good. What I really try to do is have all of the people in both of those categories be both good and bad.
If you just joined us, David Dow is my guest this hour. His debut novel is called Confessions of an Innocent Man. In real life, David Dow has represented over 100 death row inmates along with his team during these inmates' state and federal appeals. Confessions of an Innocent Man is the title of his debut novel. I have sat together in the cells of convicted murderers here in Iowa at the Iowa State Penitentiary, got to know them for a few minutes at least. We do not have the death penalty in Iowa. We haven't since the mid-1960s. It was outlawed in 1965. David, I found, though, your portrayal of the mindset of someone not facing a life sentence but experiencing a sentence of death to be very experienced, very, very convincing and very compelling. Tell us about how you made that so authentic. It had to draw from your numerous contacts with inmates, some of whom have been executed.
Many of whom have been executed. And I have found that inmates fall generally into three categories. There are some inmates who I think appreciate or realize almost from the day that they arrive on death row that they are almost certainly going to be executed. And the reason that they arrive at that conclusion is because they just do the math, and it's not higher level math, it's pretty simple math. Almost everybody who gets convicted and sentenced to death ultimately gets executed. So some guys arrive on death row and realize from the outset that they're almost certainly going to be executed. And they, from the moment that they arrive on death row, are resigned to that. And I would say that that resignation affects probably half, maybe as high as three quarters of the guys who I've represented. It doesn't mean that they tell their lawyer, hey, I want to surrender my appeals. Hey, I want to be executed tomorrow. A handful of them do. But for most of them, despite the fact that life on death row is really quite terrible, and I think I indicate pretty clearly in the book that life on death row is pretty terrible, and the death row environment that I paint in the book is, at some level, it's a figment of my imagination because obviously I've never lived on death row, but I have lots of clients who live on death row, and so I know what the circumstances are like, and I've seen video recordings of guards treating inmates poorly in prison, and I've seen videotapes of teams of guards extracting inmates from cells. So whenever I talk about those sorts of things, whether it's inmate extractions or inmates being taken to the shower or the exercise yard or whatever it is, those are pretty realistic. What you read in the book is something that corresponds very closely to reality. And some of the guys who arrive on death row and realize from day one that they're almost certainly going to be executed, some of those guys say, hey, I really don't want to live like this, and I'm going to surrender my appeals. But that's the smaller number. The larger number are people who take the view that a desiccated life is still better than no life. And so that's one group. The second group are, it's a very small number, but it's the guys who are just sure they're going to win for whatever reason. They're sure that they have a winning legal issue and that they are not, in fact, going to be executed. And in a way, those are the hardest clients because, mathematically speaking, they're wrong. And I know that, and any reasonable person knows that, but they have convinced themselves that they are going to win. And so when they lose and lose and lose, because these appeals do have multiple layers, they can sometimes become increasingly hard to maintain good relationships with because they will tend to blame the lawyer, blame the judges, blame whomever for getting in the way of what they were sure was going to be a different result. And then there's the final category, and the final category are the people who they at some level realize they're going to lose, but they're not resigned to it because they remain hopeful. And those are inmates who, when they arrive, they think, well, I'm probably not going to win, but I have a chance. And that little glimmer of hopefulness gets gradually extinguished. It doesn't happen all at once, but it gets gradually extinguished. And I would say that that group, that third group that I just identified, probably occupies the middle in terms of the numbers of them. Now, you'll notice, Ben, that I haven't said anything about people who are innocent. And one of the reasons that I haven't is because most people on death row are obviously not innocent. There are some who are. Estimates range from 4 to 9%, and that coincides very closely with my own experience. I've represented about 110, 115 guys, and seven of them are people I believe to be innocent. Raphael, the central character in this book, is one of those innocent inmates. He's one of the innocent ones. And what's particularly interesting about innocent inmates, and I try to show this in the character of Raphael, is that when they arrive on death row, they are very frequently like that first group of inmates that I mentioned, the ones who arrive and they realize, holy smoke, I'm going to lose for sure, because everybody loses. Mm-hmm. And yet it's something that they just can't process. They just are unable to wrap their heads around the fact that they are almost certainly going to lose because they know they didn't do it. And that's obviously a small number of inmates because it's not a huge number that are innocent. But I wanted to write a book where I had those two psychological features that were both present. That is, on the one hand, the inmate knows that he's innocent, but on the other hand, he looks around and he sees everybody who he knows being executed, whether they have good legal claims or not. And so he thinks, oh my gosh, this is going to happen to me too. And I didn't even kill anybody.
David Dow is my guest. Confessions of an Innocent Man, his debut novel. Yeah, that's right. Raphael starts, well, he has confidence in the system when he's being tried for this crime, this murder of his wife. He eventually loses confidence there, and then he has confidence that he will be somehow exonerated. David, in your real-life work, it sounds like you have seen people you know, to your belief, to be 100% innocent, having spoken words with them right before their execution.
Yes, I've had, as I mentioned a moment ago, maybe I didn't say the number, I can't remember. I've represented seven guys who I think are innocent. Two of them, we walked out of prison altogether. We proved they were innocent. They got out. One of them died while he was in prison. He died from a disease before we could prove that he was innocent, although I'm confident if he had survived, we would have been able to. And so that accounts for three out of the seven. Two were executed, and two are still alive. Their cases are ongoing. And the two who were executed are people who I believe to my very core were innocent, but I couldn't prove the people who matter that they were innocent. And yes, I speak to all of my clients moments before they're executed, and having a conversation with a client who has always protested his innocence and who you believe to be innocent is just a terribly difficult conversation. I mean, I've only had to have it twice, and on both occasions, as you can imagine, they're terrible conversations, but because you feel not only like you've failed as a lawyer, but you feel like you have failed as a human being, that you have allowed the system to execute somebody who didn't do anything wrong. And obviously, in writing the book, the people who I was creating, who are the people who bear that burden, are Raphael's legal team. And he has a legal team that that comprises three lawyers, and these three lawyers know the math. And the math is that almost everybody gets executed, but they also believe him. And one of the things that lawyers have to do, and that his lawyers do, and I talk about this in the book, one of the things that lawyers have to do is decide which issues they're going to raise for somebody. And Raphael doesn't want his lawyers to raise any issues that might result in his getting off of death row but remaining in prison. Mm. His view is that it's going to be all or nothing. Either they're going to get me out of here or I'm going to be executed. And on the one hand, if you're trying to put yourself in the place of Raphael, the inmate, that I think makes a lot of sense. If you feel like you didn't do anything, you don't really want to spend the rest of your life in prison. And on the other hand, when Raphael tells his lawyers that, it puts them in a terribly difficult position of having to agree with him that they will not raise certain issues, even though they think the issues might be good, and just focus everything on getting him out of prison. So
it sounds like a position that you've yourself have been in with your team.
I have been in that position, and I've been in that position twice, and it's an unenviable position because you are literally betting everything that you have on a single claim. And lawyers don't like to do that, and death penalty lawyers really don't like to do that.
Mm-hmm. We have about 2 or 3 minutes before the break. David, talk a little bit about, help us understand a little bit about your appeals with death penalty inmates. Do you have to prove them innocent? What is your goal? Do you have to just establish a reasonable doubt that they didn't do it? Talk about the options you face there when you have someone, and how you select them in the first place. Do you have to believe they're innocent first?
It's never a requirement that you believe that your client is innocent in order to try to prove that your client is innocent. If the evidence suggests innocence, then the evidence suggests innocence. I tell the lawyers who work with me, I tell my team, I don't care what you think. I don't care what you believe, because we're not in the think-belief business. We're in the business of looking at the evidence and asking what a reasonable fact finder would conclude given the collection of factual propositions that we have. So I don't really ever ask the question of whether I believe somebody. That said, there are some people I just believe. There are some guys I go talk to, and I don't know anything about their case when I first meet them, because I try to meet my clients before I even know what they did, for reasons we can maybe talk about after the break. And I'll go meet guys, and they'll say, I didn't do it. And there are some guys who I believe, and there are some guys who I don't believe. But ultimately, that belief doesn't really have much of an impact on what I pursue. To answer your question, Ben, the burden of proving that somebody is innocent is extremely daunting. As Raphael's lawyer, who is chief lawyer, who's a woman named Olvido, tells him that it is harder to prove that somebody who is innocent is in fact innocent than it is to convict somebody who is innocent. And the reason is that at the trial, what the prosecutors had to prove was that Raphael was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and the jury that sentenced him to death believed that he was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But then once that moment passes, once you're then convicted and sentenced to death and you're on death row, the burden that his new lawyers had, and Olvido, I think, communicates this to him very clearly, is she has to prove beyond all doubt that he is innocent. Mm-hmm. And so it's an asymmetrical burden. The burden of proof that she has to meet later on is even higher than the burden of proof that the government had to meet at his trial. And what it all adds up to is a regime where it's hard to prove that people who didn't commit a crime didn't commit the crime.
David Dow, stay with us. From Houston, Texas, David Dow is with us, a legal scholar, historian. He has represented with his team, over 100 death row inmates in real life during their state and federal appeals. We're talking about this and about his debut novel, Confessions of an Innocent Man. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with David Dow in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us from Houston today, David Dow. His novel, Confessions of an Innocent Man, tells the story of a hardworking son of poor Mexican immigrants wrongly convicted of murder, in fact, the murder of his wife. He uses vengeance and retribution as a form of justice. We're talking about David's novel also because he has represented with his team over 100 death row inmates during their state and federal appeals. He's founder and director of the Texas Innocence Network, also Cullen Professor at the University of Houston Law Center, and the Rorschach Visiting Professor of History at Rice University. Also the author of several nonfiction books on the topic of capital punishment. You do get a sense of unfairness, David Dow, when I read your novel, which has a lot of the truth that you have experienced over the decades working with death row inmates in it. Let's talk a little bit about the role of forensic evidence in your fictional character's conviction and how that plays out in real life. convictions and appeals to the death penalty. Do you see that forensic evidence in this country in trials is treated scientifically?
Yes, that's a the question that you're asking is an excellent one, and the answer is dynamic. There are some types of evidence that are known as scientific evidence that are really not scientific at all. There might be somebody who thinks that it is. There might be a group of people who think that it is, but it doesn't satisfy it doesn't satisfy a rigorous definition of what counts as science. And there have been types of evidence that people have thought of as scientific, and we later find out that they're not. So I'll just give you a classic example. A classic example is something like hair analysis. It used to be the case that there were analysts, and the analysts would say, oh, we recovered these hairs at the crime scene, and the hairs positively match the hairs of the defendant, for example. Well, there isn't any scientific basis for comparing a hair that you collect at a crime scene to a hair on the top of the head of the person who is sitting at the defense table in the courtroom. And yet you would have these witnesses, and they would wear lab coats, and they would have scientific degrees from college or graduate school. And so the judges would let this testimony in as scientific, and then the jurors would believe the scientists because, after all, they're scientists. And we had all kinds of people who were convicted, some in death penalty cases, some in non-death penalty cases, on the basis of this hair comparison or fiber comparison, and it turns out that all of it was entirely bogus. So there are some things that we call scientific evidence that really aren't scientific at all. There are other things that we call scientific evidence that really are scientific. And so the gold standard for that is DNA analysis. And one of the reasons that in the book I have Raphael ultimately exonerated on the basis of DNA evidence is that to the extent that human beings can be certain about anything, we can be certain when there's DNA evidence that either proves that somebody did not commit the crime or makes it very likely that they did. Classic example is you might have a rape murder, and the person who committed the crime left biological material. It might have been semen. It might have been blood. It might have been saliva. It doesn't really matter. You can get a DNA profile from any of those sources of fluids. And the laboratory collects the sample. They construct a DNA profile, and it is consistent with somebody or inconsistent with somebody. If it's inconsistent with somebody, we can be sure, to the extent human beings can be sure about anything, that the person did not commit the crime. Now, the problem when we're talking about people on death row is that most death penalty cases don't have DNA associated with them. The classic type of crime that involves DNA is a rape or a sexual assault. There are other types of crimes that will involve DNA where there's a lot of blood at the scene, for example. But most death penalty cases are not DNA cases. And so what that means is that the person is probably going to be convicted on the basis of some other type of evidence that is non-scientific evidence, like eyewitnesses or confession or simply circumstances. But what it also means is that if the person is wrongfully convicted, it's going to be very, very, very difficult to prove that the person was wrongfully convicted, because obviously if there's not DNA evidence available to convict the person, there's also not DNA evidence available to exonerate the person.
Mm-hmm. I ask you about forensics, David, also because I don't know if you're aware that Iowa State University is the home of the Center for Statistics and Applications in Forensic Evidence. It goes by the acronym CSAFE, part of a nationwide effort to make forensic evidence in court better reflect science. On this program not too long ago, I spoke with the director, Alicia Carey-Curry, of that. And I wonder, with you as a person who's been at work at this for decades, are we getting better at treating forensic evidence with the proper degree of, integrity with science where it is appropriate?
I think that we are getting better. I think that the criminal justice system in general is getting better, and I think that in particular it's getting better when it comes to forensic and scientific evidence. I think judges are better at making sure that before something can be characterized as scientific evidence, it actually meets scientific standards. I think the courts are better at periodically reviewing whether some certain category of evidence is still reliable. Some category of evidence might be deemed reliable, then we might find out later that it's a little bit less reliable than we thought. And I think that courts are better at revisiting earlier judgments. And I also think that laboratories are better at obtaining and testing evidence. There's been a movement in the United States over the last decade or so to separate crime labs from police departments. Once upon a time, most crime labs were part of police departments, and that obviously can create very powerful conflicts of interest if the person who's paying your paycheck is the person who wants to see the conviction happen. Then that can put pressure on forensic analysts to lean one way or the other based on the fact that they want to make their boss happy rather than because the evidence points that way. And in recent years, we have separated crime labs from police departments, so we get rid of that sort of pressure. I think that what's important to emphasize, Ben, and I'm sure that the guests that you had on from the university made the same point, is that even when you're talking about scientific evidence, there is still human effort that is involved. And so because human beings can make mistakes, even when they're dealing with crime scene evidence, the fact that human beings can make mistakes means that even if the evidence is scientific, that doesn't mean that it's foolproof. Mm. So, for example, you still have to have human beings collect the samples at the crime scene. You still have to have human beings make sure that they don't cross-contaminate samples. You still have to have human beings who put the samples into machines. And so there's a lot of opportunity for the human beings to err. And so on the one hand, I think that we are better about policing what counts as scientific and revisiting judgments that we make. But on the other hand, I think that we also have to continue to be very vigilant about remembering that human beings are involved in this process and human beings can make mistakes. And of course, the history of science is littered with examples of conclusions that turned out to have been severely compromised, not because the underlying science was bad, but just because human beings mucked up the science.
If you just joined us, we have final 10 minutes with legal scholar, historian David Dow. He has a novel out, Confessions of an Innocent Man. He is also founder and director of the Texas Innocence Network. Let me ask you a little bit for Iowa Public Radio listeners about Iowa. As I mentioned earlier in the program, our last execution in Iowa was in 1963, March of 1963. It was outlawed in 1965. However, there have been in many, many sessions of the legislature since then, most recently this year, certain bills that have made their way to whatever degree through the legislature, not obviously to becoming law, to reinstate the death penalty in some cases. In this most recent case, a bill made its way some way through the legislature to impose the death penalty if it's a first-degree murder and if also a kidnapping and a sexual abuse against a minor is involved. I guess putting that out there, a number of people would agree that that person may deserve not to live anymore. I want you to, as a person who defends and works on the appeals of people who some you don't necessarily know that they're innocent, speak to the survivors who may be listening right now, family members who have lost a loved one to a heinous murder. What do you say to them to convince them, or do you, that the death penalty is not warranted, even in the most wicked cases of murder?
Thank you very much for asking me that, Ben. I want to introduce my answer to that just by making a autobiographical point, which is that when I first started representing death row inmates 25 years ago, I was not against the death penalty. I took on my first case because there was a man in Texas who was facing execution and he did not have a lawyer. And back at that time, he was not guaranteed a lawyer. So guys on death row depended on volunteers to represent them on their way to getting executed. And I wasn't against the death penalty, and I told the person who asked me to handle the case that I wasn't against the death penalty, but I also very firmly believed that we shouldn't be executing people without lawyers. And so when I started working on these cases, I was not a death penalty opponent. I wouldn't say that I was wildly in favor of the death penalty. It was just not particularly an issue that I spent all that much time thinking about. And then probably for the first 5 or 6 years that I represented death row inmates, I still wasn't against the death penalty. I obviously didn't think my own clients should be executed, but I didn't have much of an opinion on whether somebody who was in the cell next door to one of my clients should be executed. So when you ask me what would I say to a person who believes that somebody who kills somebody should be executed, I don't have to think hypothetically. I used to be that person. I think what I would probably say to you is that I don't really think that most people who turn against the death penalty turn against it because they suddenly decide that it is immoral, per se. That wasn't what influenced me. What influenced me, I think, were two different sets of considerations, one I call a lawyer's moment and one I call a human moment. The lawyer's moment was the realization that the people who are on death row are there not because they are the so-called worst of the worst, but for arbitrary reasons. So what you just asked me, Ben, is you said if there's somebody who commits this worst possible crime, you know, this truly horrible crime, what is the reason that that person shouldn't be executed? And what I would say is that your question builds into it this premise that the people who are on death row are the people who do the worst things. And I think I expected that that was true when I first started representing guys on death row. I expected that everybody there was going to be like Charles Manson, you know, or Hannibal Lecter, who's the fictional character in Silence of the Lambs, the movie that maybe some of your listeners watched years ago. And when I finally met guys on death row, I realized, of course, Charles Manson was never on death row. He died of old age in prison in California, and Hannibal Lecter is a fictional character. The guys who I met were there because they were guys who committed a crime in a county where the district attorney really liked to pursue the death penalty, or because they had a really bad lawyer, or very often because of their race or the race of the victim, or because they didn't have resources to hire expert witnesses. And I understand we live in a capitalist system, and I believe in capitalism. I think that it's a wonderful economic system, and I think that it generates a ideal political system. And what that means, obviously, though, is that there's going to be some inequality. And so people who make a whole lot of money, they get to travel on private jets, and people who make less, they have to go on the bus. People who make a whole lot of money, they get cutting-edge health care, and people who make less, they have to go to the community clinic. I understand all of that. That's the price that we pay. I believe as a lawyer that the one place where wealth should not matter is the criminal justice system. The Supreme Court of the United States says equal justice under law. It's not supposed to matter whether you're rich or poor. If you committed the crime, you're supposed to get convicted. If you didn't, you're supposed to be acquitted. And what I found in my early years of representing death row inmates was that there's not equality under the law, that race matters, that economic matters. And to me as a lawyer, that was just intolerable. So you've asked me this abstract question, what would I tell to the family member or to the people who argue that this person did something horrible and should be executed? What I would say is that when we're talking about crime and punishment, we're talking about comparisons. Is what this person did worse than what somebody else did? And if not, should we be punishing this person more harshly? And what I discovered was that we don't really have a criminal justice system that treats like people alike and different people differently. It treats people arbitrarily based on factors I think shouldn't matter. The second point that I want to mention about myself is that I also had what I call this human moment rather than a lawyer's moment. And the human moment was simply that I got to know my clients in a way that it's not that it's inconsistent with the crime that you just characterized. It's that it's richer than the description of the crime you just characterized. You characterized a bad guy who commits a horrible crime. Maybe he rapes and murders. Maybe he kidnaps and murders. Maybe he does all of the above. Maybe he tortures a child and murders. And I accept that there are people who did that, and they should be punished very severely. But when I say I had a human moment, I would go meet these guys, and all that I knew about them before was the crime that they committed, in the same way that you, Ben, just described it, that it was somebody who raped and tortured and then killed a child. And then you go meet the person and you find out that, yes, your client did that, and your client did a horrible thing. But there are other things about your client, too. Your client might have a mom and dad who love him. He might have a partner, a wife. He might have, very often, sons and daughters. And you learn all of these things about your clients that are simply richer than the truly horrible thing that he did. And most of my clients, of course, they don't deny doing the horrible thing that they did, but you get to know them, and you get to know them as just more than that person. And so what I would say to somebody who thinks that the murderer should be executed is, I would say, I used to think that too, and I don't think it anymore, and I can tell you why I don't think it. But I wouldn't really try to persuade that person. I had to come to the point that I'm at on my own, and on my own time, and based on my own experience. And I realize that there are people who disagree with that, and I would not try to push them towards agreeing with me. I would simply tell them why it is I changed my mind. Mm-hmm. If there's a single objective fact that I think, or maybe two objective facts that I would identify for people, because maybe people think that these facts are germane to where they stand on the death penalty. One I would say is that district attorneys and prosecutors in general like to talk a lot about closure. They like to say that the reason that a family member of a murder victim deserves to see the bad guy executed is because they deserve closure. And I just hate that, because I've known a lot of family members of murder victims, and I have never, ever known one. I'm not saying the person doesn't exist, mm-hmm. but I'm saying I've never met the person who, on the day after the bad guy is executed, wakes up and is all of a sudden healed. I just haven't seen it happen. I just think that it's this myth. And so one fact that I think bears some digging apart is whether closure is really just a myth. The second thing I would say is just the death penalty is really expensive. I mean, one of the reasons that it doesn't come back in states that don't have it, and this includes Iowa, is because policymakers realize that it's just way more expensive than the alternative. If somebody commits murder and agrees to plead guilty and says, you can send me to prison for the rest of my life, the cost to the government of the legal proceedings and keeping the person in prison for the rest of his life is going to be about $1 million. If the government says, yes, you committed this crime and we're going to try you with capital murder, we're going to seek to execute you, the cost to the government is at least twice that. It's at least $2 million. And in some cases, it's $4 or $5 million. And in the case of a really notorious crime like the Boston Marathon bomber, it's probably closer to $20 million. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just the question of whether we should be executing somebody. It's the question of whether we should be executing somebody where the price tag for doing that is so high. And we probably have to devote an entire hour to talking about why the price tag is so high. But the reason is because I think we all generally agree that if we're going to have a death penalty, it needs to have all sorts of procedures that minimize mistakes to the extent that a human process can have mistakes minimized. And when you do that, it just costs a lot.
David Dow, we have less than a minute to answer this question, if you could, in this final minute. Where are we headed in this country? Do you think someday there will no longer be a death penalty in all 50 states?
I don't think that all 50 states will eliminate the death penalty, because there will be some people who say we need to save it just in case there's another Boston Marathon bombing. We need to save it just in case there's another 9/11. But I think that with the exception of those sorts of notorious crimes, it'll go away. Not that we'll erase the laws from the statute books, but simply that we won't use it. And the reason that we won't use it is because it costs too much, and we can keep society safe just by putting bad guys in prison without the need to execute them.
David Dow, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Ben.
David Dow from Houston, Texas, live this hour. Confessions of an Innocent Man, his novel. He's represented over 100 death row inmates during their state and federal appeals. Also written nonfiction books on the topic of capital punishment. Confessions of an Innocent Man. He's also founder and director of the Texas Innocence Network. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Caitlin Harrop. Help today also from Camus Leeson. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.